Tuesday will kick your ass slightly. This I love. Hustler slash hustling. Very honest. Cool and successful at having bangs. And dangerous when overheated. Do you think all of these are accurate?
Definitely true. I get really mad when I'm hot.
That was a list of facts compiled by Adam J. Kurtz about our guest on today's episode of Well Made, Tuesday Bassin. I'm your host, Stefan Ango, co-founder of Lumi, and I'm going to try and keep this intro short. Tuesday Bassin is a rising star in the world of illustration. She has a style that I just love. It's witty, it's simple, it's very distinctive, but it's also honest. And we explore in this episode where that honesty came from. Was it her upbringing in Nebraska? Was it the depressing experience she had living in New York? Or was it freeing herself from all of that and moving to Los Angeles, where so many amazing things have been happening for her? I'll let you be the judge. Tuesday Bassin, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's exciting because we actually don't do that many in-person interviews.
Oh, really?
Yeah, most of the time it's over Skype. So you drove down here for nothing.
Well, you know, my store and my studio are in Chinatown.
Well, you know,
it's really close.
Yeah, it is very close. And do you know the brewery?
Yeah.
I lived at the brewery for about 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Chinatown's the next cool place.
I just really love Chinatown in general. Like, I didn't move
there to
like...
This is a whole topic on my list.
Oh, really? Okay,
Chinatown.
Cool. Chinatown. Yes. I didn't move there because I was like trend forecasting or anything. Well, first of all, I wanted something that was kind of close to home, but not in my neighborhood. And I found our store when I was going out to eat, and I just stumbled upon this plaza, the Mandarin Plaza. At the time, all of the storefronts were vacant, but still had like their original signs from the 70s when it was built. It's like a really tranquil atmosphere. Otherwise, Chinatown's pretty frantic, you know, and I like that too. But it felt like one of the quieter pockets that I had found of LA without being like bougie or in the hills or something, you know. And it just felt like a really special space to me that seemed to like foster that kind of quiet, and it would seem like private and just kind of like magical. And that's obviously where I want my shop to be. I kind of like that my shop doesn't actually have street front visibility, like when you come across it. I think it feels
well. There's something
you found a secret.
There's something special. I don't know how to put my finger on it, but Chinatown is obviously it's been around. When did they? You said they started in the 70s. Been around for much longer than that.
It's been around for a really long time, but actually, Los Angeles raised Chinatown.
Hmm.
They tore down all of Chinatown to build Union Station. What we know is Chinatown now used to be Sonora Town. It's essentially, you know, like ghettos that they were placing different races in. So Sonora Town was like a Hispanic population. And the city of Los Angeles kind of helped rebuild Chinatown, but did it in a way that it would be useful to Hollywood. Then when you think of LA Chinatown and you think of those like crazy colorful buildings, that was built by Hollywood.
Wow.
So that they could use it in films about China, but film it in the United States. So that's why it's such like a theatrical version.
It's like a Disneyland interpretation of China.
Yeah. And I mean, it's beautiful. It's so cool and interesting.
Well, and part of that is the layers of the decades of people who've either lived there or started their shops and restaurants and banks and all these different things in the neighborhood, and real Chinese people also lived there. Now it's weird, right? Because it seems like a big part of that population is moving out of Chinatown these days, but it's also still a landmark of Los Angeles.
I think that there's still a sizable population that lives in Chinatown, but I think a lot of people moved to the Valley just to have like a life that they chose instead of, you know, like an area that they were relegated to. And it's interesting because the plaza that I'm in isn't that like kind of weird LA fantasy Chinatown, you know, that you see. It was built in, I think, 77, and my landlord's father was one of the original builders. And he had pictured it to be kind of like a small business mall or like an artist mall. So I couldn't like find out any information about the plaza. I was like relentless trying to figure it out because there are all these spaces. And I was like, this is perfect. This is where I want to be. This is it. And around the same time, I had already moved my studio into the old United Foods building, which used to be the main slaughterhouse in Chinatown, but is now just like kind of a weird mini mall without windows.
Oh yeah, I know, like, what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. It's like my next door neighbor is like a dollar store, and then on the other side of me is like an herbalist. My landlord there, Jason, I was talking to him about it, and I was like, yeah, do you have any bigger spaces, you know, because I was kind of trying to like figure out who had that plaza or if I had to like give up and, you know, look somewhere else. But he was like, oh yeah, I don't, but my uncles do. And I was like, who are your uncles? And it turned out that his uncles owned Mandarin Plaza. So keeping it all in the family.
Okay. So your shop opened in August, right?
Yeah.
So it's only been open for a couple months now.
Yeah. Fresh.
And how's it going?
Really good. Yeah. It's awesome.
Looks like there was a pretty big opening. How's it been since then?
It's been really great. We have hosted about an event a week, sometimes like two events a week, which has been really fun. I mean, Friend Mart, which is the name of my store, started out as a pop-up series. So when we decided to open a brick and mortar, we wanted it to still have the same feeling because we liked being able to bring in like food vendors and, you know, different people in the Los Angeles kind of illustration scene or maker scene. And we just wanted to continue doing that at the shop as well. So we'll do things like a patch sewing event where Julie from Mokwebi Threads will bring her industrial sewing machine and sew any like patches that you haven't adhered to your stuff already. Or Ben, that owns the shop with me, does custom embroidery pretty much all the time that we're open. And we'll have like local food entrepreneurs like 100 Tacos or Dream Pops or Yeasty Boys come by. So it's been really fun because it's kind of felt like a nonstop party. And luckily, I'm not the one that's there every day. Like, I love being there, but I like also being able to be in my studio and then choosing when I see people. So,
but how would you describe the concept of the store overall? Obviously, there's the event side that you just described. There's the stuff that's happening on site live, and then presumably like the stuff that you sell there.
Our kind of tagline is good stuff for you and your friends by us and our friends. And we try to carry only artist-made, artist-run businesses. So instead of carrying, you know, businesses that commission an artist for not very much money, we try to carry artists that own every part of their business. I think it ends up being a more interesting product because, like, if someone who has the original vision can carry it out to, like, the last bit, you know, there's a lot more consideration for, like, packaging and materials and whatever. And I think it just ends up feeling pretty magical. So we carry a lot of different kinds of artist made goods. Like, we have shoes, clothing, accessories, patches, pins. So to me, it's like the best of all of like my wish list that I've made over the years. And yeah, it's really fun.
This is getting straight into like the nitty gritty, but what is the relationship that you have with the artists whose work you're selling? Are you buying their products at wholesale, or are they like in consignment there, or how does that work? Have you found like the best relationship there?
The first day that we were open, we did consignment just because I didn't know how well the shop would do. And so the original people that we carried were mostly artists that I already knew or had relationships with that kind of like understood what a risk it was, because I didn't want to put that burden on people I didn't know, or, you know, order too much and have it be a burden on the artist. But after the first day and the opening night was such an awesome success that we were just like, okay, that's it. Let's pay them all out and, you know, let's move to wholesale, because I think it's so much better to just be able to like pay people up front for the goods that you're making if you believe in them. So that's what we do now, wholesale.
I think it's really challenging to find the like most fair approach to do it, because even when you're doing it wholesale, I can imagine as an artist like seeing your work be doubled in terms of the price when you have to go to a store is already like I wish I could get that margin. Like, there's always that aspect that is challenging when you're working directly with artists. And I think that's why so many artists nowadays, I mean, yourself included, are building their own shops where they get to interact with the customer directly.
For sure. Well, you know, it is like a bummer to have to hand over essentially half. But I think myself, I guess I can't speak for other people, but to me, I see a relationship with like local businesses, especially something for me like Hello Holiday in Omaha. They were the first retailer that carried my work, and I see Megan and Sarah that own it as people that I admire and people that are my friends, and they're building a community in their town that, you know, appreciates my work which is cool. And I think by supporting local businesses, not just like selling online or selling your own stuff, you can kind of grow your own fan base, but also, you know, support the people that want to support you. You know, it's like a mutual beneficial relationship. So I think that's really positive. And as long as you're like thinking in terms of like what you have to charge to make retail feasible, then it's fine. Especially because usually a store will order a minimum of 20 pieces at least. So financially, it seems worth its while as long as you're getting that money up front.
How did the idea of the store come about? How long was it simmering before you guys figured it out?
Oh my God, I've always wanted to have a store.
Always.
Always. My mom owns two pottery shops and my dad is a dog trainer and sells pet supplies.
Okay.
And my uncle and grandfather own like a wine and liquor store. And I don't know, to me, it's always been like
runs in the family.
Yeah. It's not scary to me because it's like I've always seen it, you know, like my mom was a teenager when I was born and didn't go to college and yet like opened up these businesses and, you know, they're pretty successful now, which is great. But I think watching her do it with like so little to be prepared with, you know what I mean? Like, except for like a loan that she secured from the bank is pretty incredible. So I kind of felt like, well, if she can do it, I can do it. And then there's resources like SBA.gov, which made me feel like, oh, this is easy.
I can do this.
Yeah.
Well, do you know what gave your mom the courage to?
I think she just hates being told what to do, to be honest.
Do you think you take after her in that way?
Definitely. I think it drives my boyfriend crazy because when we're together, we're just like constantly butting heads because we both have really strong opinions about what we should be doing at any given time. So yeah, definitely.
It's interesting because I think a lot of artists and designers are maybe a little bit intimidated by starting their own business. And yet it is like the greatest source of freedom in a certain way. Like it sounds scary, but at the same time, if you don't do it, you never really have a means to do the thing that you love in a way.
Right. Well, I guess it depends on what freedom means to you because, you know, for some people, freedom is knowing that they're going to get a paycheck at the same time every month.
Not having the liability of having the store and employees and people that you need to pay and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and that is daunting and something that's not to be taken lightly at all, but it still feels freeing to me to know that it's like me doing it and me controlling it. And that feels really good. I know like for my boyfriend, Ben, who I opened up Friend Mart with, he's like an incredible designer and embroiderer. And he was the art director at Vagrant Records for 11 years. And he felt really secure there. And I think that was a kind of freedom, but I think it was just time for him to leave. They got bought out by BMG and it wasn't the same atmosphere he had had before. And I really pressured him into quitting because I was like, you could do anything, you know, and I kind of dragged him along. And he loves having the shop, but I can see that for me, having the shop is really freeing. And for him, being self-employed is super fucking scary. So,
yeah. Well, so you started freelancing right out of school, right?
Yeah.
And presumably you started like your own little business around that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's probably like the first step that a lot of people should take. Essentially, I think it's interesting because a lot of people that I know are afraid of starting a business, but just because their mental picture of what a business means is like, probably it's just so much more than it actually is. A business, as far as the government is concerned, is just like a mechanism for you to be able to like not pay taxes on certain things and collect money from other people.
Right.
And so in a sense, I mean, I think most people should own a business, even if it's like the most simple version of a business. I think once you get past that, then little by little, you can take it further and further as you've done. I mean, freelance is like maybe the simplest version of that. You know, you don't have that many liabilities. You're not like carrying inventory, you don't have employees, you don't have all this different kind of stuff that you have to manage, but now you have a mechanism through which you can get paid for doing work.
Yeah, for sure.
Coming out of school, did you ever think maybe I should go work at a company, or were you pretty much getting client work right out of the gate?
Well, so when I was graduating from school, I hadn't quite decided if I wanted to be freelance or work at a company. MCAD where I went to school does a really good job of hooking you up with potential clients for freelance or companies that might want to hire you. And they kind of host like a job fair of sorts where like local businesses, or not even local, you know, national businesses will come and like review portfolios. And it's like a way for young artists that are about to graduate or designers to connect with companies that might be interested in having fresh talent. So I had gotten offered a job through that at an agency in Minneapolis. But at the time, I was already doing freelance editorial illustration. I had done some work for Bust Magazine. That was like my first published thing, and I was so excited. And then Target hired me to do like a small part of their corporate window display, and I got paid $1,000 to do that project, and I was like, I'm rich. Like,
this is it. Stack them up.
This is it. I've never seen this much money in my whole life. Yeah. And also, you know, like, it's funny to tell people that live in, like, New York or L.A. because
that barely covers 1 month's rent.
Yeah, or doesn't cover. But, you know, being from Nebraska, if you are...
You can buy a house in Nebraska for that much, I think.
Yeah, well, like, $80,000, it's not that far off.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're making $30,000 a year in, like, my hometown of Lincoln, I think you're ballin'. So I felt like I was ballin', like, getting this $1,000, and I was like, I'm gonna move to New York. This is it. I have all this money. And I was like, okay, well, I'll move for 3 months. And if it doesn't work out, I can always go back to this job in Minneapolis. And if it does work out, I guess I'll see what's up. So I moved to Brooklyn with my friend Charlotte, who still had a year left of school, but she was doing some internships. We shared a sublet, teeny tiny bedroom that was as wide as an air mattress. And we borrowed an air mattress from my cousin, Nada, who lives in Brooklyn. And then I stretched that $1,000 to like 3 months worth of rent because I was sharing this air mattress with Charlotte. I moved there as soon as I graduated, basically, I think 2 weeks after I graduated. And it was like a record-breaking heat wave summer New York. And we didn't have air conditioning. And we were sleeping on this air mattress. And it's like two friends just like laying in our underwear, just like sweating it out. Like, please don't talk to me. This is like terrible, but also amazing that we, you know, that we were here. So I started getting more work. I was still very broke for a very long time, way under the poverty line in New York. And I just like shared bedrooms and sublet for a while to make it happen. I think I was like too tenacious to let it go. Like, I didn't want to get a job. I just wanted to do freelance illustration. And there was a long time where I couldn't afford to really leave my apartment. I couldn't really go on the subway because I was like, I don't even have that much, like $5 to get there and back. Oh my God, no. So I watched a lot of X-Files and like made a lot of work in that period of time. But by the end of it, I had a pretty good life in New York and like had freelanced at some ad agencies that I really liked and had good relationships with them. And I was a designer at a children's educational app company. And
Tiny Bop, yeah.
Yeah, that was a really cool experience that taught me a lot about working with a team, because as a freelancer working out of my apartment, I hadn't really learned anything about team dynamics before, and that taught me a lot about team dynamics.
Talk a little bit about Tiny Bop and what you did there.
I illustrated an app called Homes that was about houses around the world, and so there was a research team that provided me with all of this research about different houses around the world. I think we did like 16 houses, which is crazy because, you know, you have to like draw the same object from several different angles, and especially if you're doing more than one house. So if it would have just been the Brooklyn brownstone, it would have been the front of the brownstone throughout the different seasons, different cars, different animals that would be walking around, different kinds of leaves that would, you know, drop and stuff, nighttime, daytime, whatever. That's just the exterior. And then you go inside and there's like all the objects that are in the brownstone, and you draw them at like a bunch of different angles to be animated or interactive later in this app for children as a way to learn about what life is like in different places.
They're kind of like little pop-up books kind of, right?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, on your iPhone or iPad.
Yeah.
So that's what I did.
I mean, it's interesting because I feel like in your career, you've like spanned the whole gamut of like freelance, starting your own store, working at a startup, doing big projects for like Target or Urban Outfitters, you know, like big corporate type company stuff. I think it's a very interesting like balance of
all
those different things.
Gotta see what works for you.
No, I think it's great. Yeah. Because I think it's as useful to see, like, this is the type of thing that I want to do, and this is the type of thing I don't want to do.
Well, so working at Tiny Bop was really important for a lot of reasons, ultimately because it showed me that it's not what I wanted to do. Like, it was a really good experience, and it taught me a lot. But by the end of it, I was like, I can't fucking do this anymore. Like, I can't make shit for children anymore. I'd reached, like, such a breaking point where, like, my sketchbook looked so different than what I was sharing online. And I reached a point where I was like, I don't even care anymore. I'm just going to post what's in my sketchbook and what do I have to lose, really? Because I was no longer at that job. And that was like a really interesting point where you feel like you don't have anything to lose. And then all of a sudden, like, people started responding positively. And I was like, oh, so it's, I think I didn't realize that it was fine to share what I was actually interested in or the kind of work that I wanted to do. I think for so long I was worried about surviving that I wasn't being truthful with the kind of work that I wanted to make.
Well, I remember reading on your interview, which is very good, with The Great Discontent, where around that time you were feeling a bit depressed.
Oh, super depressed.
Can you tell me about why were you depressed and how did that exhibit itself and how did you come out of that?
Well, first of all, I think, though I've never been diagnosed, I think I have like a seasonal depression.
This is why Los Angeles is probably good for you.
Los Angeles is great.
Yeah.
And at the time I lived right next to the elevated expressway in Brooklyn. And my bedroom was eye level with the expressway and it was probably about 8 feet from my bedroom window, so it was like eye level, like I could look out and there would be like standstill traffic and be like, hey, you know, like when you're driving by in Brooklyn in a cab and you're like, oh, who the fuck lives there? Who would do that? Me. I would live there. And I thought it was like totally fine and I got a hell of a deal on the apartment, obviously, and so I was like, I can do anything, this is fine, it's not that bad, I'll just like put up curtains or whatever. But it was bad and
it wears on you.
And like, you know, when you're trying to like sit at your desk and ink and then a semi truck goes by and it shakes everything and then you just, you know, whatever. So, you know, the seasons, I think
New York itself is like a thing that eats you.
Yeah, it does kind of. And, you know, I just like wasn't happy with where my career was going, you know, and I wasn't happy with the relationship that I was in. And I think a lot of people feel this way that live in New York, that you're like, well, where would I go?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If I wasn't in New York, my career would be over because this is where all the jobs are. That's what I thought. And so I felt helpless because I was like, I hate my house. I hate the position that my career is in. I didn't like my relationship. I didn't like the weather. My friend group that I had for most of the time that I was in New York had kind of splintered. So I just felt like nothing was going right. And it was hard for me to pull myself out of that. So that's where the frustration was born from, where I was like, well, what do I have to lose? Literally all this shit that I cared about is just like non-existent now. So yeah, that's when I started like sharing things. You know, it was like pretty tame. Like I had like a grumpy girl face that said like, fuck you very much underneath it. Like pretty simple stuff, but you know, it was new for me.
I don't think you can understate how important that is though, because I think the world expects you to put out there, in whether it's on whatever social network you want, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, the most like polished, I'm happy, positive version of yourself. And so to put out even something as simple as that is like very challenging, I think.
Right. Well, you know, I agree with you. I think being from Nebraska too, where you always say that you're doing good if someone asks how you're doing. And I think it really took me getting to like a point where I was like, nothing's fucking good. Nothing's good at all for me to even be able to acknowledge that something was wrong, you know, and to like put something out there that wasn't like, I'm super happy and look at me drinking this iced coffee or whatever. And then so from there, I made stickers of that aforementioned drawing and they sold out like immediately. And I was really surprised by that, especially because before then I had been making like handmade ceramics that were like little wall hangings and they were kind of cute faces. So that felt really empowering. And so after that, I started making more and more products that were in line with how I felt or just doing whatever. At that point, I was like, what do I have to lose? I'm at rock bottom anyway. And I made this tote bag that said fried cunts on it. And it was like a box of fried cunts. Now I wouldn't put that out at all. But at the time, again, I was like, I mean, I don't really care. Like, this is...
It's honest.
It's honest. And that was really powerful and freeing for me. And shortly after I started putting all of this out there and like really sharing my sketchbook and like all the weird stuff that I had in my sketchbook, I visited LA on a whim. I had found some like really cheap round trip tickets, and my boyfriend at the time and I went to go see a show that we really wanted to see. And basically, as soon as I landed in LA, I had never been to Southern California before. I was like, wait, what? This is what I wanted all along. Like, I had no idea this is where I was trying to create in New York. Like, I drove everywhere in New York because I like to. Just kind of like the way people talk and communicate and like the level of privacy there is in LA. Like, that's what I wanted and was trying to create for myself in New York. And I didn't know it. And so I was only here for, I think, 2.5 days, barely a long weekend. And then I flew back to New York, and then I ended my lease and moved to LA.
Wow.
Yeah. I visited once and then was just like, that's it. This is where I want to live forever. I know it.
I feel the same way. Like, I definitely like would suffer from SAD disorder, as they call it, seasonal affective disorder. I grew up in Paris, and then I lived in Colorado, which was sunny but cold, and then I lived in Holland. It's basically, I just always lived in either somewhere very rainy or snowy or cold. And when I arrived in LA in the middle of March and it was, you know, 72 and sunny, I was like, okay, never mind. I don't care about those other places. Like, this is the place I need to be. It's just something that is like on the back of your mind that degrades your experience of life in a way that really sucks. Like 3 years ago, I was really bummed out about my work and a side job that I was doing for a long time that was really not panning out, that I was extremely depressed about. And there's this great, it's a commencement address by Neil Gaiman where he says like, make great art or something like that is like the solution to every problem. Mm-hmm. And it sounds similar to what you're talking about, is just like take control of your life and make something, just make something out of that. It doesn't have to be art, but it helps if you have that, if you have that outlet. And I mean, there's something so freeing when you hit that like rock bottom and you're like,
what have I got to lose?
Yeah, like, let's just do it. And then you realize that people really do appreciate honesty. People really like respond to when when you express yourself in a real way, because in a way we are sort of like constrained in today's society to like only showing the positive aspects of our life, or like not representing the fullness of the emotions that exist in a human.
Yeah. I remember when my parents knew that I was like super depressed, and my mom was really worried about me because I like wouldn't answer my phone and, you know, just get avoidant when you're depressed. And she and my dad, their big thing they do, they don't really like give presents. They just like go to Mexico one place once a year. That's their like their gift to each other. And I think my mom was just like, oh my God, we have to do something because this kid is just like dying. And in an insanely generous thing to me, she was like, hey, instead of Christmas and birthday presents, do you want to come with to Mexico this one time, you know? And I was like, I mean, I don't even think I was that excited, because I wasn't excited about anything at that time. But when I got to Mexico and I was just like laying on the beach, I just remember it was February, like my last year, my last couple months. I didn't even realize it at the time, in New York. And I was just like tears streaming down my face being in the sunshine, like,
no,
never again. I'm just going to stay. I'm practically live in Mexico now, and it's great. I love it.
So you moved to LA, found yourself among the palm trees, the sun. How did you find the like little clique of friends and people that you're kind of a part of now?
You know, honestly, I didn't really know anybody in LA before I moved here. When I first moved here, I lived with an acquaintance that I had met when I visited that worked at a bookstore I went to.
Okay.
We just like became pen pals.
That's enough.
Yeah. And so she was like, hey, this is weird, but my friend is buying a house. Do you want to come rent a room from it for a little bit, just until whatever you decide you want to do? And I was like, sure, that's enough. And so I just moved here and was like, I guess I'll see what's up. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I came to LA without knowing anybody, but knowing that what I wanted to do was I wanted to make use of the space here. I wanted to do more large scale projects that I couldn't do in New York. And at the time, I thought I wanted to expand my ceramic line. And I've since changed my mind, you know, but I'm kind of doing that now with making clothing. And I wanted to also, use the like incredible amount of American manufacturing that Los Angeles has, you know, just with like sewing and embroidery and knitting and fabrication.
I'm always talking about this, but it's like,
it's incredible.
It's the most underrated thing about Los Angeles that people don't know. People think of Hollywood, obviously, but there is, it's a
American
huge
manufacturing. It's
huge,
amazing.
Huge
it's
manufacturing town. Anything that you can ever come up with, there's someone who can help you do that.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I think it's awesome because, you know, oftentimes my couch, for example, like I think it was like really the price of like an IKEA couch to have this guy, Mark in El Monte, build a custom couch for me, you know, and it's like incredible to be able to just like give your money to
an artisan, yeah,
or like, you know, a small business owner that employs other local people,
yeah,
instead of just, you know, like a faceless corporation. So I wanted to make good use of the manufacturing here. And so I was so excited about the move to Los Angeles and just being in Los Angeles. For a while, I really didn't have any friends. And I was totally cool with that. I was just like, I'm just so happy to be here. Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. And it's incredible because my first real friends in LA were the Little Friends of Printmaking. Do you know their work?
I've seen their work. Yeah.
Yeah. They were like my heroes when I was in high school. Like they were from the Midwest too.
Yeah.
And at the time I was like, oh my God, maybe someday, like if I try hard enough, I could be as good as James and Melissa from the Little Friends of Printmaking. And then, you know, just through the magic of the internet, you meet people, and Melissa and James are probably my closest friends here now. It was just really incredible because I got here and then like my heroes became my best friends. And
how did that happen?
Just, you know, like
you emailed them or something.
I met them, I don't know, just by like existing here. We're like Twitter friends or something, and you know, we both went to a show, and then now we have like a standing Sunday night dinner, and I see them otherwise too. They helped build all of the wall hangings for Friend Mart and stuff. They like put it all up because I was like, I don't know, I'm going to fuck this up if I do it, you know, and they were really generous with their time and did all of that. So I don't know. It's been incredible. Like kismet. I just feel like all I knew was that I wanted to be here and I was happy to be here. And I think other people maybe could sense that I was excited to be here, and just was a really good feeling of a lot of people that were just like chose to live here or were from here and still were in love with it. So,
well, not to bring the whole thing down, but we have to talk about the Zara thing. So tell a little bit about the story of like what happened and how you found out about it.
So, I mean, you know, since moving to LA, I expanded my product line, which is what we were just talking about, to, you know, be a lot more like pins, patches, clothing, other accessories. And I think earlier this year, time moves in such a weird flat circle in LA. I can't even remember when like anything has happened. But in recent memory, Zara started reproducing my artwork.
Yeah.
Without my permission. And it started with a few things that like I didn't know if I could pursue because they had changed enough about it. And if you know about copyright law, you know how.
Yeah, there's enough of a little bit of a tweak,
right,
that it makes,
you know,
it legal.
If they changed it 30%, then it's legal. You know what I mean? Which obviously there's reasons why it is like that, because we all have similar ideas, blah, blah, blah. So I didn't know if I could pursue those because they had changed it enough, even though they were images that were like very central to my work. But as time went on, I think because I wasn't speaking up,
people found out about it.
Well, I was getting hundreds of DMs from people who followed my work that were like, hey, I noticed this.
Yeah.
Have you seen this yet? It was like one item, two items, three items, four items. And I was like, this is getting ridiculous. But I felt a little powerless still. And then finally, it got to be so blatant that
yeah,
I was
so
like,
blatant.
I was like, I can't ignore this anymore.
Well, I mean, it's not just that they took some of your illustrations and made like
they
posters.
They took my whole catalog and then just made the same thing.
Yeah, it was not like just the appropriation of the artwork, but to literally take something that you had turned into a product, like a pin, and make that exact same pin.
Yes.
That is like so egregious. It's crazy.
Oh, it's crazy. And I went to go see one of the items in person, because before then I was like kind of trying to ignore it, you know. It was my girl's pennant illustration, which is, you know, pretty simple, but I made it. It's like obvious that I made it. And they had put the patch on some shorts, and I went to go see it in the mall, and I saw it, and I was just like, Like seeing a photograph is one thing, but then seeing it in person,
so shameless,
feels so, I can't even, outrageous. Like it was just like, I feel like I kept standing there like guffawing over like this pair of shorts. Like I can't believe I can touch this with my hands. And this is at this mall in the Valley, which means that it's everywhere. You know what I mean? It's in Dubai. It's in New York. It's in Paris. It's like thousands and thousands of articles of clothing, probably maybe a million articles of clothing. I mean, they're the world's largest fast fashion corporation. So they have a lot of stores and move a lot of stock. And I was like, okay, well, this can't stand. And I reached out to my lawyer and she sent them a cease and desist, and their response.
Wait. I have it. I wrote it down.
Oh, my God.
It was so good that I had to write it down. The lack of distinctiveness of your client's purported designs, purported designs, makes it very hard to see how a significant part of the population anywhere in the world would associate the signs with Tuesday Basin.
And then they followed it up with, essentially, you have 90,000 customers, but we have
90 million 90 or something.
Billion customers. So no one's going to even know it's you. Like literally that's what they said.
Well, that seems so outrageous because it's not an admission of guilt or anything.
No,
it's like,
just like,
yeah, we did it.
Big and we're big and you're like just a tiny ant we could crush.
It's such a weird response when you actually think about it, because you would think that they wouldn't even bother to respond if that was really going to be their response. They would say something simpler, but instead they actually went out and actively said, like, we don't care if we're stealing. You don't matter as a person.
Yes. Yeah, totally.
So insulting.
Well, I mean, like, I get why they do that, because to most people, that response would be, it would crush them.
It would
like,
be scary.
It's so belittling and scary. Like, what do you do with that?
Yeah.
You know, people are like rightfully scared. I'm not saying that it's like weak at all. If someone got that response and then they were like, oh, I don't know what I can do. They are the world's largest fast fashion corporation.
Sure.
Period. Their owner is the richest man in the world.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck? You know, like, what can I do? Especially as an artist with like a limited income. What can I do? And I was just like, you know what? Fuck this. I don't even fucking care. And I just like,
you were past the like New York
this
point.
This is like yet again, like, what do I have to lose?
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, like the theme of my life. And I just was like very honest on Twitter, like very off the cuff. Like, you know what? Honestly, sometimes it sucks to be an artist because companies like Zara rip you off. And then when you send them a formal cease and desist, this is what they say back to you.
It turned out to be many more designers than just you.
Yes. So, I mean, eventually we uncovered, and my lawyer has since uncovered more designs that they stole from me that I didn't know about. But, you know, Adam, whose list you read from, he was also stolen from, and he rallied all of these other artists that had also been stolen from. And it's something like 30 other designs other than my work this year alone, which is crazy. So essentially any accessory, any patch that you've seen on an article of clothing from them
was probably
stolen. Yeah.
And the solution is so simple. Like the thing
just
is they could
artist.
Have just
Jeez.
Asked you, can we give you, you know.
But that's the problem, because that is literally their MO, like that's their whole business strategy. The only difference is instead of ripping off runway designers, they're going the other direction and they're ripping off teeny tiny independent designers.
Yeah.
So it's not a surprise, because their whole business model revolves around knockoffs. It's just, if they're knocking off Chanel, less people care,
mm-hmm.
because only a percentage of the population can afford Chanel to begin with, right? Doesn't mean it's okay, but that's, I think, why there was less outrage from the beginning. Versus ripping off my work or, you know, any of the 30 other artists, I specifically diversify my price points so it can be accessible to anyone. I have $3 stickers, $10 pins. I have $150 satin jacket made in LA, and that's as expensive as it gets. So to steal my work is insane, because you can literally buy my pin for the same price that you're buying from them. And it's really inexcusable, because I think it's clear from their letter from their lawyer that they just don't care, because they won't get caught.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make sure they got caught, because you can't let things like that stand. If you let people abuse you, they're just going to keep doing it unless you speak up. So yeah, it was an insane amount of media after I spoke out against them, which was really cool that so many people cared. I wasn't expecting that. I just needed to like get it off my chest and then figure out what I wanted to do, take next steps. But the unfortunate side effect, I think, I've seen a lot with like younger designers is so many little baby designers in like high school or fresh in college have shared with me that they now feel nervous to share their work, because they're worried that they're going to have to fight a fight like this. And that's depressing, because it's your intellectual property. You shouldn't have to defend it this fiercely. Just because you put something out in the world doesn't mean that you should have to be prepared to like drop thousands of dollars to like defend it, you know? So yeah, I think that's really awful.
It sucks, because in a way, Zara has the most amazing distribution platform that it could provide to artists.
Oh,
like they could
totally
flip this around in a way that would be a boon to artists. Like you said, I mean, maybe some of the pins that they sold, you know, whether it's that or a different type of product that they might try to rip off, it just seems like it would be so much more valuable to them as a business to like almost provide that as a service to artists. Like they could actually turn this around in a way that would be beneficial to them.
Oh yeah. And I mean, there's still time. They can do that if they want. They can do it retroactively.
Yeah.
They could do that retroactively and move forward with some artists probably that they infringed upon, and it would end up being a positive thing.
Well, I've actually never spoken about this publicly, and I won't go too much into detail, but one of the products that I worked on for like 4 years got completely ripped off at every level, including the fact that like I wrote all the copy on the packaging and all this different stuff. And like I remember the same feeling that you had going into a store and looking at that product on the shelf and reading like almost word for word like copy that I had written. And the feeling that I had was like, do you people have no shame? Like, how can you have no shame? How can you be so lazy and so shameless?
Right.
It just like someone had to make that decision. There's a person at Zara. There's a person at this company that I'm talking about that you can go talk to.
Yeah.
And they made the call. They said, yes, this is okay.
Yeah.
And that I don't know. Like, I really, it just like, how do they sleep at night? I guess is the question that I have to ask myself.
If you're the world's richest man.
But it's not, that's not him who made that decision.
No, it's definitely not. But it is people that he hired, you know.
But it's an individual person, you know.
Yeah.
And this is how stuff like this happens. It's like everyone in the organization kind of like lets it happen and nobody speaks up. And it's like,
well, I'm sure if they speak up, they'd get fired. So, I mean, you have to think about like what a toxic atmosphere that is for people who are kind of trapped in a position where like they have to be a yes man, you know, because like, what are they going to do? Take a stand and leave, and then they're not going to tell anybody about it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't fault some of the smaller employees that much with this.
They're just doing their job.
Which I don't feel like is a total excuse, but at the same time, especially in our like economy that values the top crust so highly, I don't blame them for wanting to keep their job. Like, you know, I heard privately from some retail employees that this happens all the time.
Yeah.
And the management acknowledges it, and they're like, well, we're just going to wait until this goes away, essentially, and then we'll move on.
To them, it's okay, because even if there's blowback, even if people find out, it's just like a blip, you know, as far as their finances are concerned, it doesn't even affect it. And no matter how much press this like controversy gets, it's still like 99% of their customers never even found out about
right.
it. And so it doesn't affect them in the least. And that's the part that's kind of a bummer. And the way I feel is like when you have to deal with that, the only response that you can have on the, I think, second or third episode of the podcast, we had the founder, Matt McAdan from This Is Ground, and he like designed this thing called the Cord Taco that Target ripped off and like now has been able to like get some royalties off of that product. It is possible to like get made whole in a sense out of that. But I think the real solution is to keep going, like to keep right. making new stuff. You have to keep moving along
for sure.
as fast as possible, create as much as possible, because if it's not Zara who's copying you, it'll be like
someone else,
like some smaller thing that is not even significant in that respect. They're just like lazy or shameless right. in their own right. And like the only thing you can do is just like keep going, keep creating, keep making new stuff.
Right.
I don't know. That motivates me to some extent. It's just like trying to keep ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's overwhelming for some people and I can understand why it would be, but I feel the same. I'm constantly like, okay, what's next? What's next? And that's, you know, what I think might make me an annoying friend, but I think helps me a lot. I feel like all of my friends are just as neurotic as I am, so it's not an issue, but I definitely like get something done and then I'm like, okay, now what? You know? And I think that's positive when you're making new.
But yeah, you've launched your clothing line mm-hmm. on your website. You've launched the store, mm-hmm. The physical store. It sounds like you have a lot of different projects. Is the zine still going on, or you have
Ugly Girl Gang?
Yeah,
yeah. I need to put out a new one.
I'm just saying you have all these outlets, yeah. and I think it's really exciting. I also noticed that I think. Is Urban Outfitters like selling your stuff also now?
Yeah.
So that's great. I mean, I think Urban Outfitters has also been like an offender in the past
for
of
sure.
like stealing designs. So like if we can turn these corporations around, it seems to be a good thing.
Well, you know, like Urban definitely has been like an offender in the past. But for me personally, like as an artist, they've haven't been anything but extremely supportive. Before Friendmart was a store, they like hosted a lot of Friendmart pop-ups at their event space for free, which, you know, I'm sure like is good for them too. But, you know, they place large orders with me consistently and like trust me when I put out new products. And, you know, when, you know, all the whole Zara debacle was coming out, one of my buyers reached out to me and was like, hey, do you want to work on like an exclusive product for us
yeah.
to help offset some of your lawyer fees?
Wow, that's
which
cool.
I thought was really incredible. I mean, and that's like a personal relationship that I have with a buyer that, you know, I've developed over the years now.
Revenge. I saw this. I saw a patch on your Instagram said everything sucks except revenge.
Oh, yeah. I actually made that one for Tess Holiday. She's a really cool plus size model that does like a lot to change beauty standards or, you know, just subvert them a little bit from what they are now.
Yeah. Have you ever read Count of Monte Cristo or seen the like movie?
I think I've seen it, but I don't.
It's like epic story of this guy who like it's like a 30-year like revenge plot. Anyway,
I think I would get tired after like 30 years. Like I'd move on to something else at that
yeah.
point.
Well, I think there's like an active form of revenge where you just literally want, you know, murder the person who did something bad to you 30 years ago. Or there's like the very simple form that I was describing, which is just keep making good stuff. Don't let it faze
yeah.
you.
Well, I think like being happy is the best form of revenge.
That's going to be, yeah, that's going to be the title of this episode.
Being happy is the best form of revenge. Well, you know, it's like you can make an active choice to do things that make you feel good. You know yeah. what I mean? Like, I'm not saying that you can just pull yourself out of depression whenever or anything, but day by day there's like things that you can actively do to make yourself feel better. And I feel like that's the best, like not being miserable is such a fuck you to people who want to see you fail.
I love that. Well, I want to say thank you very much. We're gonna have to have you back for a whole 3-hour episode about Nebraska. But in the meantime, what should people do if they're curious about your work?
You can visit I feel like my shop is most up to date now. It's shoptuesday.com or my website, which is tuesdaybasson.com. Or if you're in Los Angeles, you can check out my store, Friendmart, and we carry a bunch of different artist goods.
Very exciting.
Great. Thank you so much.